All right, let's look at 1 Kings 17, if you would, please. We are looking at a study of the kings of Israel and Judah, and we're looking at Ahab. So actually begin in chapter 16 and verse 28. So Omri slept with his fathers and was buried in Samaria, and Ahab, his son, reigned in his stead. In the 38th year of Asa, king of Judah, began Ahab, the son of Omri, to reign over Israel. And Ahab, son of Omri, reigned over Israel and Samaria 22 years. Okay, so we've looked at several kings of Israel here that have had a shorter tenure. Nadab, which was 2 years or less. Baasha was longer. And then Elah. And then you had an assassination, and you had Zimri and Omri. Okay, so all of these kings in the north have had these shorter times, while the long reign of Asa in the south has been going on. So Ahab becomes king in the 38th year of Asa. He was the son of Omri, which doesn't tell us a whole lot other than we know that Omri was an idolater. And in fact, in the book of Micah, Israel is condemned for following the statutes or laws of Omri. So Omri apparently had an influence in the wickedness of Ahab. So his father was a military man who was, and he was also an idolater. Omri was a warrior, but he also apparently arranged a marriage that was significant. Okay, as far as his reign, we see here in verses 28 through 34 of chapter 16, basically an overview summary. And then we get more of the familiar stories in the following chapters from chapter 17 to 22. But we're told that he began to reign in the 38th year of Asa, and he reigned 22 years. Okay, verse number 30, Ahab, the son of Omri, did evil in the sight of the Lord above all that were before him. All right, now, that is quite a statement, because Jeroboam has preceded him. His father Omri was pretty wicked as well. But Ahab managed to do more wickedly than his predecessors. Now look at verse 31. And it came to pass, as if it had been a light thing for him to walk in the sins of Jeroboam the son of Nebat. So in other words, he's saying this is bad, but he did something worse. If it was a light thing, or a small inconsequential thing. If it had been a light thing, which obviously it wasn't, he went further. It says that he took to wife Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Zidonians, and went and served Baal and worshipped him. Okay? So, his wife, as we know, was Jezebel. We're familiar with that name. Any of you know anybody who has named a child Jezebel? Or Ahab, for that matter. Probably not. If someone were to be called a Jezebel, would that be a complimentary term or a derogatory and insulting term? Okay, I think we understand the answer to that one, okay? But Jezebel, I do believe that Bel in the end of her name is related to the name Baal, okay? Different commentaries take it different ways, but I do think there's a connection there. But notice again in verse 31, he took to wife Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Zidonians. It was very common in that culture when they were making peace between countries that the daughter of one king would marry the son of the other as a symbolic thing. In other words, I'm not going to attack you as long as my children and grandchildren are part of your country, and you're not going to attack me as long as your child and grandchildren are part of our country. And it was kind of the seal of a treaty. That is quite possibly what happened here. But notice her father is named Ethbaal. Okay, the name Ethbaal means with Baal. Okay, so I mean, this is an election year. So it's already starting, but in the next few months, we will get overrun with commercials and mailings and those kind of things, with this one, that one, the other one. But, I'm with so-and-so. I mean, even recently in the Roe v. Wade decision, some would say, well, I'm with the Supreme Court on this one, or, you know, I'm against the Supreme Court on this one, right? That's been a fairly well understood statement. But I think that with bail means that he was with bail in service. F. Bail was all in on that. And I think, you know, if you take it the other way, bail is with him. It was said that Baal's blessings were on him for whatever that's worth, okay? But what this tells us then is that Jezebel's father was very involved in Baal worship, quite possibly even a priest in the worship of Baal. Okay, now, when we talked about it before, when we talked about Jeroboam and the calves, I showed you different pictures and idols and images and that kind of thing. But many of those pictures that we looked at were related to a cow or a calf, right? There were several images for Baal that were related to a cow. In some cases, it was a man standing on the back of the cow, but very often that was a symbol of strength, and you know, the bull was a symbol of fertility and reproduction. It's interesting how many of the false religions had that. In essence, they worshipped something that was viewed as giving life, whether it was the bull, which could increase your herd, you know, or the sun, which, you know, gives life to the crops, or in Egypt, the Nile River, which, you know, gave life in the middle of otherwise desert land. But it's interesting how many false religions worship what they perceive to be the source of life and the source of power instead of the Creator, who is the source of life and power, right? But it seems like Jezebel's father was a priest and a heavily devoted servant of Baal. Now, it says that he was king of the Zidonians, okay? If you make that an S, and if you turn that Z into an S, okay, instead of Zidonians, if you put Sidonians, what would that look like? Tyre and Sidon, and that's what this is talking about, okay? Sidonians, Zidonians, it's the same region, okay? But so these are neighbors of Israel to the north, in what would be modern-day Syria, you know, Phoenicia in that region. The Sidonians worshiped Baal, and they also worshiped Astarte. If you remember from our discussion a few weeks ago about the idols, Astarte, also called Ishtar, was the chief female goddess, often, you know, paired with Baal. But Astarte was the female god of fertility and stuff, and very often immorality was associated with those worship rituals and so forth. But that's Jezebel's background. Okay, now, you think Ahab knew anything about that, you know, before he married her? Probably. Now, in that culture, it may well have been that the parents arranged this deal, and it is what it is. What we learn later about Ahab is that Jezebel had more backbone than he did at times. So, you know, she definitely had an influence there. But Jezebel was extremely devoted to the worship of Baal, and we see why. Her father was a priest of Baal. I was very, very heavily involved in that. In fact, when there's the confrontation with Elijah, the priests of Baal were called, you know, whose servants? Jezebel's. Okay? And who was it that threatened to kill him because Elijah had taken out the prophets of Baal? It was Jezebel. Okay? So, you know, that is the context. How could Ahab be worse than the ones before him? Well, Jeroboam used the symbol of a calf, which was very well accepted in that region. They had it in Egypt, they had it in Palestine, they had it in, you know, Babylon and Assyria. It was very well represented in that region, but now instead of it being just their symbol for the God of Israel, well, now they've gone full out to worship Baal, not even pretend to worship the God of Israel. Okay, in the rest of chapter 16 here, we're told that he built an altar and a grove for Baal, which very often the grove was connected with that. Those were, you know, sometimes trees that were planted, you know, in a specific pattern for a certain way, and sometimes that referred to a tree that had been carved with images of idols and so forth. I mean, it's not exactly what I'm getting ready to tell you, but if you think a totem pole, which is a pole with different carvings and that kind of thing on it, sometimes it was something similar to that that was associated with the idolatrous worship there, okay? So, in verse 34, you see a very interesting little nugget dropped. In his days did Hiel the Bethlehemite build Jericho. He laid the foundation thereof in Abiram, his firstborn, and set up the gates thereof in his youngest son, Segub. That was the curse that Joshua had pronounced on Jericho. When Israel conquered it, he said, this city's not to be rebuilt. And if anybody does this, he'll lay the foundation in his firstborn and he'll erect the walls in his youngest son, meaning if you start this, it's going to cost you one son, and if you follow through with this project, it's going to cost you another son. Well, and this nugget is recorded just to show that God keeps his word, all right? But anyway, that's the introductory material on Ahab, and then that brings us to chapter number 17. Now, chapter 17 is more familiar, 1 Kings 17. And Elijah the Tishbite, who was of the inhabitants of Gilead, said unto Ahab. Now, this is just kind of abrupt subject change, isn't it? You got Ahab, and he married Jezebel, and her father was a priest of Baal, and oh, boom, Elijah the Tishbite. Where'd he come from? Well, this is just kind of an abrupt introduction here. He was of the inhabitants of Gilead. All right, where's Gilead in Israel? South, central, north? It's north, north central, right? But where was the capital of Israel at this point? Ahab's father, Omri, had captured Samaria, and he'd moved the capital there. So it's kind of central, all right? But all we know about Elijah, you know, he was of the inhabitants of Gilead. He showed up to Ahab and said, as the Lord God of Israel liveth, before whom I stand, there shall not be dew nor rain these years, but according to my word. So you have the confrontation with Elijah. He says, oh, no rain. I think there's a very important phrase there. As the Lord God of Israel liveth, before whom I stand. I think that phrase there, before whom I stand, is indicative of a pattern. Okay, Elijah didn't just show up to Ahab one day and say, God's going to judge you, because I'm going to name it and claim it. You know, there was an established relationship before whom I stand. He stood before God as a servant. You know, he stood before God in fellowship on a regular basis before God sent him to do this. He says, there shall not be dew nor rain these years, but according to my word. Now, usually around here, July is when it gets really hot and the rain is very sparse. It kind of flipped this year. June was pretty hot and dry. I mean, it got really hot earlier than normal. And then, you know, the last couple of weeks, the Lord's given us rain. Okay, but, I mean, for those of you that have gardens, okay, when it got really hot the end of May and early June and there's no rain, what happens to your gardens or your tomato plants? Yeah, not much. I mean, the leaves start dropping because it's so hot. Even if you're watering it, it's crazy. And that unexpected cycle can really mess with things. Right now, I mean, for those of you that do your lawn because it's your duty, the lack of rain, you know, doesn't necessarily disappoint. You know, if that's how you earn a living or, you know, make extra income, it's a bad thing not to have rain, you know, if the grass isn't growing. But I mean, just we saw in June, right, the grass turned brown. It was almost crunchy and all of that. And that was what, 3-4 weeks? And we might have had, you know, one shower in there, but we went about 3 weeks with no rain. And it got brown and crunchy and gardens and crops were affected. All right, now, what happens if there's no rain for 3 years? And remember, this is Israel, so this is more of a hot climate, you know, year-round. This isn't a moderate type of a situation. But, okay, well, I'm going to use the water out of the rain barrel. How long is that going to last? I'm going to use the water out of the creek. Well, eventually, after 3 years, if there's no rain, the rivers dry up and the water sources go dry as well, right? So this is a pretty big deal. We tend to think, rain, no rain, I'll just turn on the faucet. Doesn't work that way. I mean, it came as rain to one of the water sources, you know, from wherever our water comes from, whether you have a well on your property or you have municipal water. But this is a big deal. There's not going to be any rain for 3 years, according to my word. Now, God had told Elijah to do this. Okay? But did this was this kind of a fun assignment? You know, it'd be like, hey, Jim, I want you to go, you know, stand in front of the president and tell him that there's not going to be any rain in this country until he gets rid of all these executive orders that are contrary to the word of God. You think Jim would be like, yeah, he picked me. This is awesome. No, it's like if I go do this and he doesn't like it, I'm in jail. And I mean, in this case, the king could take off your head if you don't like it, right? So what I'm saying is, did it take some courage for Elijah to do this? Absolutely. Okay, obedience to God is necessary, whether it's fun or easy, or whether it's, you know, difficult or uncomfortable. But here, Elijah shows up and says, there's going to be no rain for 3 years, according to my word. And the way this is presented, he shows up, he delivers the message, and he leaves. Just like the evangelist, right? Blow in, blow up, blow out. Anyway, verse number 2, the word of the Lord came unto him, saying, get thee hence, and turn thee eastward, and hide thyself by the brook Cherith that is before Jordan. Now, you have kids or grandkids. You know, maybe you play hide and seek, and, you know, that's not that big a deal. But have you ever tried to hide because you thought you were in trouble? Right, all the angelic faces here. But have you ever had to hide because you thought somebody was after you to harm you or take your life? I mean, for many of us, no. For some here with military background, yes. Okay? But, you know, Elijah was told, all right, you better go hide. Oh, great. Now, even if that was the case, what would you be thinking? Let me set up a security camera. Wait a minute, they didn't have those. God told him to go hide himself, you know, by the brook Cherith. So you have the brook Cherith is where he went. It's very interesting. The name Cherith means cutting. Okay? In Hebrew, the phrase to make a covenant is literally this word, to cut a covenant. It was because of the old procedure for making a covenant where the animals would be cut in half and they would lay the pieces on either side. And then the two parties that were making the covenant, they would walk through together. It's symbolically saying, all right, we're making this agreement, and if either one of us breaks the agreement, the same thing will happen to us as happened to these animals, to be cut in half. I mean, that was the symbolism of it, okay? So it was, but it's the same word here, Cherith, Kerith, okay? So God told him to hide himself by the brook Cherith that is before Jordan. So apparently this was a smaller stream that fed into the Jordan River. And it shall be that thou shalt drink of the brook, and I've commanded the ravens to feed thee there. Well, good. I got water. You know, I'll be okay. Now, the raven is what kind of bird? It's an unclean bird in the Old Testament, for sure. It's, yes, it's a dirty bird. It's, you know, a vicious bird. This is not one you'd want as a pet. Okay? And this was not natural at all. Okay, God said, I've commanded the ravens to feed you there. What's normal about that? Nothing. I mean, you ever see the birds around here, especially in the summer, it's worse, but, you know, the animals run across the road and they get run over. You ever see the birds fighting with each other over who gets it? Yeah? I mean, I've seen birds nearly get hit by a vehicle because they're hanging on to it so long to try to, you know, protect their prize. Well, I mean, the ravens are more in that category. They were, in some cases, you know, a flesh-eating animal. But they were unclean. They were dirty. So the place Cherith means cutting. What do you think God was trying to cut away from Elijah at this point? I think what you're going to see here is God was doing some work on Elijah while he was doing work on Ahab too. But what was he cutting away from Elijah? All right, this is where you interact and give feedback here. Pride. Yeah, God used him. It's not going to rain for 3 years. Now God put him in the middle of nowhere where nobody could see him or hear him. Yeah, absolutely. Cutting away his pride. Yeah, he was cutting away self-dependence and increasing faith. Because is he going to, well, nobody goes to McDonald's on purpose, right? You know, is he going to Arby's or Wendy's? Oh, man. Whew. Let me introduce you to Angus Thick Burgers. All right. Anyway, total sidetrack. Wherever your favorite place is to go, he wasn't going to fast food place. Okay. He wasn't going to Ingles or Super Walmart or even Dollar General. I mean, he was hiding out for his life. And so God's increasing his faith by cutting away the things on which he can depend. I mean, that would never happen to us in, you know, like, fuel prices going up and grocery prices going up and, you know, everything getting uncomfortably tight. You know, that would never happen in your life, but it happened to Elijah. I mean, what else might God be cutting away here? Think of anything? I think the self-dependence is a lot of it. You know, teaching him faith, cutting away any pride of maybe we could say here his own plans. I mean, how long did he sit there? I would say it's a minimum months. Eventually, the brook dried up, but it didn't happen immediately. So I think God left him here weeks and months. I mean, we know the total time was 3 years. But God left him there. What about, we talk about increasing his faith. What about that circumstance made sense? I'm going to stay in the same place, and Ahab's not going to find me. Does that make sense? I mean, my way of thinking would be I got to, you know, keep on the move to make sure, you know, he doesn't eventually narrow it down and find me. I mean, what about depending on a scavenger bird makes sense? Nothing. Okay. What if the scavenger did go to McDonald's, you know, instead of going to Outback to bring him his evening meal? You got to eat whatever the scavenger bird brings, right? Was that not a miracle of God to override the natural tendencies of these scavenger birds to feed Elijah? All right, and how much did they bring at one time? Notice in verse number 6, the ravens brought him bread and flesh in the morning and bread and flesh in the evening, and he drank of the brook. So the birds only brought him one meal at a time. They didn't bring him a Sam's or Costco load. You know, they brought him one meal at a time. Isn't that in the Lord's model prayer? Give us this day our what bread? Daily, our day-by-day provision. So the Lord's teaching him that daily dependence and that ongoing. Do you think, from what we know of Elijah, was he the kind to sit around and twiddle his thumbs? Or was he seen to be more a man of action? I mean, I take him as a little more of a man of action. I mean, even if you're looking for, you know, a break from your regular schedule, how long do you want to be have downtime before it's like, all right, this is enough of this, I want something to do? Now, that answer varies from person to person. I get that. But 3 weeks, 4 weeks, I mean, eventually it's like, this is boring. I mean, I've already determined how many times I can skip a rock on top of this brook. You know, I've already scouted all the trees within walking distance. I mean, what is he doing? Building a hut there? I don't know. Put a hammock between two trees? He didn't have to worry about getting rained on, right? I don't know what his living conditions were. But, I mean, after a while, I'm just telling you, what are you doing? I'm hanging out by the brook. That sounds like fun. What are you doing today? Hanging out by the brook. What you been doing the last few weeks, Elijah? Hanging out by the brook. What are you doing tomorrow? Apparently hanging out by the brook. You think he ever got agitated, ready to do something else, frustrated? If he did, okay. But he would have been out of the will of God if he moved anywhere else until God told him, right? Okay? And you would never get impatient like that, you know, but I would imagine Elijah was tempted that way. obviously. I'm being a little bit facetious, but do we ever think, okay, it's time for something to happen here, and it hasn't happened? It's time to move on to something else, and the Lord's not giving any clear direction? Yeah, that happens all the time. God works on His schedule and lets us adjust to His calendar. It's not always on our calendar, but He was there for an open-ended amount of time. You know, the New Testament talks about things that are to be put away from us, right? 1 Corinthians 13, verse 11 says that we're to put away childish things. Ephesians 4 says, putting away, verse 25, wherefore putting away lying, speak every man truth with his neighbor, for your members one of another. Later on in Ephesians 4, it says, let all bitterness, wrath, anger, clamor, and evil speaking be put away from you with all malice. You know, there are things that God's trying to put away in our lives too. And sometimes Cherith isn't just one time. It's a periodic thing where the Lord is doing His pruning work. But God left him at Cherith for a while. What's going on with Ahab? You know, regular routine, fussing, griping about the weather, lack of rain, and there's a manhunt on for Elijah. All right, so then eventually what happened? Verse number 7, it came to pass after a while, because the brook dried up because there had been no rain. Verse 8, the word of the Lord came unto him, saying, arise, get thee to Zarephath, which belongeth to Zidon, and dwell there. Behold, I've commanded a widow woman there to sustain thee. So now we have Zarephath. The word, or the name Zarephath, comes from Zaraph, which is the first part of that word, is the Hebrew word for to smelt, and not, you know, like past tense of the verb smell. It is to smelt, as in to melt down and refine metal ore. Okay, so that name Zarephath was a place of refining. So God sent him on to Zarephath. He had done some cutting, and now he's going to do some polishing, if you will. He's going to continue to remove some impurities. He sends him to Zarephath. And he says, behold, there, I've got a farm for you to work. Is that what it says? No, I've got you an unlimited pass for Golden Corral. What does it say there in the end of verse 9? I have commanded who to sustain thee? Widow woman. Now, I think that this would go against the grain. I know it was against the grain of the culture. I think this would go against the grain of Elijah's bent as well, right? It ought to have been the other way around. They were to try to help take care of the fatherless and widows, right? And if a fellow's worth his salt, he wants to contribute to his keep or provide for himself, get work and take care of himself and family if he has one. Here God says, nope, Elijah, you're not done. You're going to, you remember this lesson of, cutting away pride? Well, now we're going to polish that up because you're going to go depend on a widow woman. You're going to depend on someone other than yourself. Now, does the Lord ever try to teach us that lesson? Yeah. Maybe not necessarily through a widow woman, but does the Lord use various and sundry methods to teach us not to depend on ourselves? I would say, yeah, absolutely. So he shows up, verse 10, he arose and went to Zarephath. Now that's important, okay? Because the brook at Cherith has dried up. At some point in time, the ravens are going to stop coming. But if he says, I don't want to go stay with no widow woman, that's beneath me. Was he going to experience God's provision? No. Was he going to have God's blessing and protection? No. God's blessing and protection was there where he'd placed him, where he had sent him. Okay? When God sent him to Cherith, he was to stay there. When God sent him to Zarephath, that's where God's provision was going to be. So guess what? If he stays at Cherith, he's missing what God's providing in Zarephath. So, and he arose and went to Zarephath. He obeyed. Very important step. And when he came to the gate of the city, behold, the widow woman was there gathering sticks. And he called to her and said, fetch me, I pray thee, a little water in a vessel that I may drink. Did she complain about that? No. Verse 11, as she was going to fetch it, he called to her and said, bring me, I pray thee, a morsel of bread in thine hand. And she said, as the Lord thy God liveth, I have not a cake, if I could say it this way, a biscuit or a loaf. I have a handful of meal in a barrel and a little oil in a cruse. And behold, I'm gathering two sticks that I may go in and dress it for me and my son that we may eat it and die. You ever seen any of those commercials where they show you these malnourished children and, you know, try to play on your sympathies? I mean, can you envision something like that? I mean, if she's been stretching this out as long as she can, they haven't been eating three meals a day or even two meals a day. It's been, all right, we got one biscuit, half for you and half for me, and we'll have a little bit again tomorrow. I mean, that's what's going on there. But, I mean, if you read this and it doesn't cross your mind, you're just kind of buzzing through too fast. Hey, widow woman, can you give me a bite to eat? I'm sorry, all I have is a handful of meal, and however big her hand was, that's not a whole lot of flour, okay? And a little bit of oil, and I'm going to make a loaf. Now, how long did, apparently this was small, because how much wood was she getting for the fire? Two sticks. Didn't need a big fire, wasn't going to take long to cook it, okay? If that doesn't tug at your heartstrings a little bit, something's wrong, I think. But at this point, it would have been like, oh, I'm sorry. You know, I did not mean to, you know, be insensitive. Now, I mean, that's what we would think if we had not known the rest of the story, right? God had told Elijah, here's what I want you to do. I've commanded a widow woman there to feed you. Do you think the thought crossed his mind, maybe I got the wrong widow woman? Okay, but notice what he says here. Verse 13, Elijah said unto her, fear not, go and do as thou hast said, but make me thereof a little cake, what? First. Now, normally, me first is a bad attitude, okay? But here, this was not Elijah's being selfish. This was Elijah following God's direction, and in essence, Elijah is asking the woman to have faith in God, right? So when she demonstrates faith in God by feeding the man of God and trusting God to supply for her, ultimately, she and her son are taken care of as well. God's working on Elijah. He's working on the widow woman. And it's amazing how God can do that at the same time. He'll work on all of us at the same time in these various and sundry situations. So go make me first and bring it to me. Now notice, it wasn't totally blind. Verse 14, for thus saith the Lord God of Israel, the barrel of meal shall not waste, neither shall the cruse of oil fail until the day the Lord sendeth rain upon the earth. So he said, look, if you will do this, God will take care of you. Now she's got a choice to make. Am I going to believe the word of the prophet or not? So, did the widow woman have to exercise faith? Yes. Okay. God's working in her life as well. This whole thing is weird. Okay. Go depend on a widow woman. I don't want to do that. I only got one meal left. This is our last meal. We're going to die. Well, just feed me first and God will take care of you. I mean, this whole thing seems weird. And very often the way God works is the exact opposite of what we would have done it, you know, if we were in charge, right? If we were laying out the scenario. But here, God is continuing to refine in Elijah's life. This seemed like a presumptuous request, but we see here, along with this presumptuous request, we see a promise of God. The oil and the meal will not fail. So what did she do? Verse 15, she went and did according to the saying of Elijah, and she and he and her house did eat many days. And the barrel of meal wasted not, neither did the cruse of oil fail, according to the word of the Lord which he spake by Elijah. That was a miracle. This is just as much of a miracle with the supplies not running out as it was for ravens to bring Elijah food. Now, how long was this? A while. if we assume that it was a year or less before the brook dried up, he was at Cherith a while, but this whole saga lasted 3 years, right? Now, Zarephath, if I'm understanding it correctly, is actually in the north. It's outside of Israel. This is more up in the direction of Phoenicia, in the direction of Jezebel's hometown. So God had left him in Cherith for a while, and then God sent him up here while Ahab's continuing to search. When Elijah's eventually found, the messenger tells him, hey, Ahab has sent messengers to every country and made them swear that they're not hiding you out. So apparently he's already contacted Phoenicia, and after they said, no, we don't know anything about it, well, then God put him there, okay? But it's very likely that he was there for a couple of years until this whole scenario played out. Now, I don't know if you've ever thought about it or not. I think about a lot of things with these stories that people are like, But there's a little similarity to the manna here, don't you think? The oil and the meal didn't run out, but what else did they have? And they had, you know, squash and yellow squash and zucchini. They have cucumbers and tomatoes. No, they had meal and oil. So it was some form of, you know, pancakes or biscuits or loaf bread or whatever they could do with it, but they survived. Okay. When Trisha and I first got married, the church had a a food, they call it a pounding. They said, we're going to have a pounding for you. And I'm like, I hadn't been here long enough to get in trouble. What in the world's going on, you know? Well, come to find out, it was like bring a pound of this or a pound of that. It was like a pantry filling type of a shower. And so we got, you know, a lot of things, but in that we got a lot of spaghetti, noodles, and sauce. Okay? I used to like spaghetti. it was what the Lord provided. We ate a lot of spaghetti. And it got a certain point where it's like, ooh, can we just leave that off the rotation for a while? I mean, now it's like, okay, if we put spaghetti back on the rotation, but there for a while, we ate it multiple times a week. And see, my wife is the oldest of, you know, four children, and so when she had fixed meals for the family, she was fixing for six people. She'd worked in the college cafeteria, so, you know, learning to scale things. We made, you know, the same amount. I mean, that's kind of the way it was at my house, too. Yeah, that looks about right. Oh, guess what? We've got enough spaghetti to eat for 4 days. So we'd make spaghetti on Monday night, and guess what I ate for lunch Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday? Leftover spaghetti. Let me just say, there came a point in time where I'm like, man, I don't care if I never see spaghetti again. But we survived. As you can tell, I'm not malnourished. You know, I didn't starve to death. But what I'm saying is they probably went through some of that same thing. What are we having today? Bread. All right, let's thank the Lord for bread. But God took care of Elijah. God took care of the widow woman and her son. And it says, and her house. So maybe, you know, her parents or, you know, other family members as well. But here at Zarephath, God is doing a refining work. He said, all right, Elijah, I've tried to teach you to be humble, to trust me, you know, to take your daily bread. Now let's take you up here to another place and see if you've learned your lesson. Let's polish you up on it some more. Well, then God's going to bring in another difficulty here, because verse number 17 came to pass after these things that the son of the woman, the mistress of the house, fell sick. So everything's going along great until it wasn't. Did God lose control? No. God is continuing to refine and to work in the lives of all of them, but particularly in Elijah. He's going to go on and have other confrontations with Ahab and have other public miracles and so forth. But when God uses someone publicly, he first is preparing them privately. And if you fail those lessons, you're not going to be prepared and useful for the public ministry part of it. So, you know, wherever we are in the scale, wherever God has you in school, learn the lessons where you are, because until we pass those courses, we're not ready for the public lesson, which ultimately, when we roll into the end of chapter 17 and into chapter 18, then we get the public message, which is Carmel, Mount Carmel, and the confrontation and calling down fire from heaven and all that. But that came after Elijah in chapter 17, verse 1 says, the Lord before whom I stand, after a walk with God, after a cutting and refining process, then God said, all right, now you're ready for this next step. Don't kick against it. Wherever God has you, ask what you're to learn. Ask him to help you to learn the lesson the first time so you don't have to repeat the course. And then just trust God day by day and say, Lord, you know, whenever you're ready, I want to serve you. I want to be used of you. And that's ultimately, we know the rest of the story, but did Elijah know how this was all going to turn out? Not at this point. Not when he's at the widow's house. He didn't know that fire's going to come down from heaven on the sacrifice and all the prophets of Baal are going to be rounded up and all. We know that, but he didn't. He was just having to trust God day by day and go along day by day. So maybe you're on Mount Carmel and everything's, you know, fireworks and it's great. Maybe you're at Cherith or Zarephath, and it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Just walk with God, be faithful, submit to His working in your life, and see, you know, what the Lord will do when you're faithful to walk with Him.